Second side. Fritz, this household had a unique atmosphere. There was something so special about it. Will you go into that now?
I'd like to mention one specific phase of my background. After the First World War, when Schoenberg, who had been in military service, returned to Vienna, penniless, but a world-famous man. And he decided around that time to found what he called Society for the Private Performance of Contemporary Music. It would take up too much time to go into the Constitution. In essence, the purpose was to give music lovers an opportunity to get acquainted with modern music in a systematic way, not haphazardly, but educationally. In concerts for subscribers only, on a regular basis. Now, if there was no money, and my brother Max was a student of Schoenberg at that time, my parents were willing and felt privileged, I should add, to give part of our apartment for the headquarters of the society, not only office space, but rehearsal rooms, as we had a music room with two pianos and so on. And rehearsals took place almost every day. So for several years, several times a day sometimes, Schoenberg, Alban Berg, and Webern came to the house to rehearse the music. Alban Berg and Webern, because they were appointed the music supervisors. Vortragsmeister, Schoenberg called their position, masters of interpretation, might be a more literal translation. And so they came, and I had the opportunity to get intimately acquainted with modern music, which was very important for me. My professional career later came in as something quite beneficial, as you can see. And Anton Webern became my principal teacher, private teacher, in theory and composition. And Edward Steuermann, the pianist, who later, after he came to this country, taught at the Juilliard School up to his death a few years ago.
Who was that Edward?
Steuermann, Steuermann. Was my piano teacher at that time. So, if I may say that I have an intimate knowledge of this kind of music that goes back to my years as a student, as a high school student and university student.
How many hours a day would you be practicing?
Well, in those years, you see, high school studies in Vienna were extremely strict, as I mentioned before, Latin and classical Greek were amongst the subjects that interested me very much, and I was not particularly good in physics and mathematics. I had to work a great deal, and the professors were very strict, and so I had only perhaps 3 hours available for piano practicing. But the important point I have already made, and I don't want to stop progress and dwell too long on this, but I cannot emphasize sufficiently the importance of that in the history of modern music. You will find references to it in every biography of Schoenberg or Berg or Webern.
It's very interesting. Are we at the point now, would you say, that we could begin to discuss your departure from Vienna?
Yes, but you see, it is not exactly overlapping, because Schoenberg left Vienna for good in 1925 and never returned to Austria, except for a visit perhaps. And I still remained 2 more years in Vienna as a coach, what we called co-repetitor and teacher of music. I began to teach privately a great deal. And finally, was very anxious, like most performers in the field of music, to go into Germany, because the opportunities were infinitely greater. You must remember that after 1918, we are not talking about the time of the Weimar Republic between the two wars, that Austria had overnight become a small country of only 7 million population. Consider the population of Austria to this day is smaller than that of New York City, the total population, that is. So the opportunities were small in Austria. In order to be a conductor, you had to go to a theater. The typical European career for conducting is to join an opera house.
Is that what you were interested in also, in conducting?
Very much so at that time, you see. All of us wanted to perform music. You see, the difference in emphasis is, whereas musicology in this country, to a certain extent, is taught in an abstract way, detached from the practice of musical performance. It was the other way around. My teacher Guido Adler, who was probably Gustav Mahler's best friend, stressed the making of music all the time. He argued that you couldn't understand the history of music if you were not a good musician yourself, that you didn't actually know what you were talking about. Anyhow, I received an engagement in a small theater in Germany. That city was Stendal, halfway between Hamburg and Berlin.
What year was this, Fritz?
28.
What city again?
Stendhal. You know the name in reference to the famous French novelist Henri Stendhal, who chose this pseudonym. His real name was Henri Pell, as you probably know, because Stendhal was the birthplace of the philosopher and aesthetician Winckelmann, who shaped the concept of classicism in terms of aesthetics.
In this position in Germany, was it for conducting?
It was for conducting in an opera theater, where I had the opportunity to do everything, from conducting operettas every night, operas, ballets. And it was desirable to go to a small theater, because at the large opera theaters, you were nobody. You were the fifth wheel of the car, because there were so many others, and you didn't have an opportunity to conduct. There I could conduct a great deal. But I stayed there only 1 year, because I found life in a small German town of that kind somewhat depressing in other ways.
You were lonely.
I was not lonely. There was a very
very
pretty actress engaged at the theater, you know. But you see, you were never lonely in such a situation, because the theater people always formed a milieu by themselves, a side of the bourgeoisie who looked at the theater people with a certain distrust.
So you stayed 1 year, and then?
Then I went to Berlin for the summer. And it so happened in Berlin, a curious accident happened. The music critic of the Berliner Morgenpost, which is the paper with the largest circulation in Germany, it still exists, by the way, Morgenpost, the Morning Post, had to give up his position almost overnight. It was some sort of an obscure story into which I do not feel like going now. It's not an attractive story. And Klemperer, who later became the music director of the Pittsburgh Symphony, as you know, he founded the major orchestra, conducted the two operas of Schoenberg. And someone had to be found to write up in the book, because almost overnight.
Someone had to be found to write it up.
You see, the first music critic, his name was Kastner, by the way, very well-known musicologist, was out of the job. And I was recommended, I happened to be in Berlin, and I was recommended to the editor-in-chief to do this one job, because I knew Schoenberg well, you know. I got the job, and I stayed up all night and worked. And I got the job of Mr. Kastner, and I stayed in Berlin as music critic of the Morgenpost from 29 to 34. But I did a lot of other music, and I conducted. I conducted, among other things, a chorus, Gross Berlin, Major Berlin, which gave the world premiere of a piece by Bertolt Brecht at that time. I prepared the performance. I did not conduct it because I was not allowed. There was a political aspect. This was a communistic group, and the editor of the paper told me that I had to make a choice between keeping my position
on the paper
or conducting this kind of politically colored work. By the way, it was performed in Pittsburgh a few years ago at Carnegie Mellon. The name of the play is Die Maßnahme, The Measures Taken. And I met Bertolt Brecht, and that was...
What's in play next?
Kleenex, if I may.
I'm
going to
survive.
Fritz,
yes, how did they pay you well? What kind of money did you make in those days?
Music criticism in Germany was taken extremely seriously for a very simple reason. The readership was well informed. Most, I don't like to say anything particularly admiringly about the German audience, which would be ridiculous, but you have to recognize that the preoccupation with music is very serious business in that part of the world. Consequently, you had to have experts writing musical reviews. Consider, for example, some of my colleagues at that time, Alfred Einstein, the famous Mozart biographer, generally considered the greatest authority on Mozart, but at that time one of the critics in Berlin. Another one was Otto Strobel, after that the intendant of the great West German Rundfunk network. I could go on and show you, you see, that the other music critics were people of great knowledge. Therefore, the pay was excellent. If you had a good position in music in Germany, you were always well off.
I think that you're making a point here that could be significant and important. That you said that preoccupation in that part of the world with music was a very serious thing.
It was a part of life. You couldn't have an orchestra go on strike. It's inconceivable. First of all, the orchestra could not go on strike because it is a state or city organization, and you cannot by law strike against the government. Neither the Vienna Opera nor the Vienna Philharmonic, for these reasons I'm giving you, could ever strike. It's a state organization, don't you see? Mm-hmm. Nor would they want to strike, nor would it be necessary, because they are civil servants and they are compensated according to the evaluation of their jobs, you see?
Now, we're talking now, I would say, we're up to 1932, 1933, 1934.
You're very right. The Nazis came in 1933 on the 30th of January, I think.
But just a moment, because
yes.
I want to say that in this country, they were thinking of things other than music as far as terribly important orchestras and very important things happening in music in this country, in the United States. Is that right? There were not these important things happening in this country.
You mean at that particular time?
At that particular time.
Well, why don't we talk about it when we come to the United States?
Fine.
For the purpose of economy of time, I know you have no unlimited time, and if you don't mind...
Exactly. I would also like to ask you, the recreation in your life, was it always music, or were there things that interested you?
Well, many other things. All the arts, if I may say so, particularly the performing arts, the theater, philosophy was always one of my great interests to this day. I love to read and I always loved to write.
And were your friends? When you were young, were they also interested in the same things?
Yes, well, you choose your friends according to what you have in common. Not always. Sometimes, as you're just coming from France, Marion, les extrêmes, c'est touche, also true. So it doesn't always work that way. But by and large, you like to share your life with people who have the same sense of values.
Share the same interests.
So the Nazis came.
All right.
And curiously, I, as an Austrian, was a foreigner in Germany and did not immediately lose my position, because in the beginning the situation was not clear, by which I'm not implying that I wanted to stay. But it wasn't so easy for me just to pack up and say I go into another country. After all, you always had to know where your next meal was coming from. It was a very difficult situation, not only emotionally, intellectually, politically, but also economically. So I finally decided in 1934 to go to France, to Paris, France, where my brother Max had been living for, I think, since 1926 or 7. And that was spent the year in France and served as music critic for the Frankfurter Zeitung, that no longer exists, but was a newspaper of great intellectual distinction, probably the best of Germany, Frankfurter Zeitung. And that, you see, was possible because I used a pseudonym, the pseudonym Dorian, and wrote reviews from Paris on music, on the theater, on film, on all the arts.
You were the French reporter for the German newspaper.
Yes, but as you asked me about economy before, about wages, that was by no means a living wage. They paid perhaps for my room and board, but hardly.
The German paper paid.
Yes, you see, I was paid only when something appeared in print. Man. You see, it wasn't a monthly salary.
Did you live with your brother in
Paris? No, not at all. Mm-hmm. All on my own. It was a very happy year because it afforded me the opportunity to study French music and French culture at the source. And as a critic, at least I had tickets. Every night I went to a concert or to the opera. But I couldn't make a living. I couldn't stay there indefinitely. And paradoxically went back to Vienna.
After 1 year?
After 1 year, you see. I went back to Vienna. Particularly I wanted to see my parents, spent the summer with them, which is spent as always in the Salzkammergut, you know, the country near Salzburg, where the Freud family always went. You see, Squirrel Hill in the summer went to a certain place.
Beachhead.
Beaches. And as coincidences happened, I went in Vienna to the only American style, couldn't call it a restaurant, a kind of an automat, near the opera, called OK, just to have a little lunch. And at this lunch place, I met a friend from Berlin, a journalist, rather well known, who told me that he had become the editor-in-chief of the Neues Wiener Journal, the Vienna Journal. And he made a joke when we were eating our Wiener Schnitzel there together for lunch. He said, "Do you know who the new music critic is?" I said, "No, I don't know." He said, "You." And appointed me right there. I did not want the job. I neither wanted to remain in Vienna, mostly because I saw the Nazi handwriting on the wall. And furthermore, I didn't want to go back to Vienna anyhow, for many reasons. But as it happened, I stayed there 1.5 years until 1936.
You took this newspaper job?
Yes, I took the job. And in 1936, through Eugene Ormandy,
and all this time, excuse me, were there any abuses of any kind because you were Jewish? Or?
Well, in Berlin,
yes.
Very much so. But in Austria, you see, we still had a government that claimed to be anti-Nazi. And I had opportunity for other work in Vienna. I taught on the radio. You see, I give lectures on the history of music and so on. But contrary to many friends and members of my family, I saw the handwriting on the wall. As I said, Eugene Ormandy, in a very strange way, got the position at Carnegie for me. Shall I tell you how?
What was he doing in Vienna?
Well, he came to Vienna every year and maintained a permanent apartment because his wife, his first wife, she's dead now, he's remarried, his first wife was Viennese. The harpist, Steffi Goyner, was Ormandy's first wife. He maintained a beautiful apartment in Vienna the year around. His mother-in-law and I think his brother-in-law, they all lived there. But when he was through with the season, he immediately came to Vienna.
What season? What was Ormandy doing then?
Music director of the Minneapolis Orchestra. The same position which after him Mitropoulos held, and now I think it's Grobachevsky. I think it was at Christmas time, 1935, then. Ormandy and his wife went on a cruise to the Caribbean. The head waiter, excuse me, placed them at a table with a gentleman who identified himself as the dean of the School of Engineering at Yale. It was Dr. Doherty. And he said he would go for the next year, academic year that is, to Pittsburgh as president of the then Carnegie Institute of Technology. Ormandy said he also would go to Pennsylvania as a new director of the Philadelphia Orchestra. Actually, he came as co-director with Stokowski there. And he asked, they became neighbors on a table to which the head waiter had assigned them. And he asked Doherty whether he could bring me over to his college. And Doherty said he would, provided there was a music department, of which he was not sure. And he came here, and I was his first appointment. And I received on the 11th of July, 1936, in Vienna, a telegram offering me the position in Pittsburgh. And I went immediately to the university library, looking up where Pittsburgh was. You know, and I couldn't figure out why something called Carnegie Institute of Technology would teach music. And whether the Indians would be riding around there and capture me with a lasso. I knew very little about Pittsburgh. See, one knew about New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles. Pittsburgh was not in focus. So I read all I could find out and sent a telegram of acceptance. I was very fortunate because technically speaking, the Nazis were not yet in Vienna. And so I came here in September 36. And it was so fortunate for me that I found here friends and kindness and hospitality, and last but not least, my wife and the family.
Fritz, you came to Pittsburgh without knowing anyone. Ormandy was in Philadelphia.
Ormandy was in Philadelphia. I knew no one at all in Pittsburgh. He gave me 4 letters of recommendation.
Did you speak English then?
I spoke English so badly that Dr. Doherty, the president, said, quote, "If Fritz would not have talked English whatsoever, would have been a great improvement over the way he talked." This was his classical evaluation. But you see, that can happen only in America. People are patient and kind and humorous. And you see, in music you can get away with it because I came also as a conductor, conducting in succession. First the choir, later the orchestra for 17 years, and years later I founded the opera department at Carnegie Mellon. So what you say is adagio, lento, you say pizzicato, and this is understandable. And the students, they are patient and they laughed when I made a mistake. It's only in the United States, I like to tell you that, that there is so much tolerance in regard to the pitfalls of a human being. I have French families, you know, and I spoke French since childhood, but I'm not in practice all the time. If I am in Paris, and my sister-in-law, who is French, if I make one mistake, if I say instead of une fois, un fois, she says it's a scandal, and I don't think she would talk to me for another week. You see, this business of coming to a country and being accepted in a friendly way, and I think the fact that I remained for 39 years in Pittsburgh has something to do with the fact that I felt kindness met me here. And also, you see, the room in which you are sitting now, after my operation, which left me in this state in which I have to use the wheelchair and so on, the president of the university, by that time it was Dr. Warner, you know the story, Marion, this apartment was built for us because the girls' dormitory, this in which we are living here, did not yet exist. It was first being built, and Dr. Warner, Jake Warner, sent the architect over, who took an interest in rehabilitation. And you see, the bathroom and all the other the doors and the exits and all of this were built for specifications.
We have to say that it's the Morwood Avenue dormitory. Is
yes.
It not?
Yes.
We must say that.
This is the, originally it was the girls' dormitory, but now you know it's, I mean, there are many boys living in here. Many
originally
things.
It was the Morwood Garden Apartments.
Morwood Garden.
The apartment building. And
apartment.
Now it's the Morwood Dormitory.
Right. Yeah.
At Fifth and...
In Forbes. At Forbes.
No, at Forbes and...
Forbes and Morwood.
And Morwood.
It's a cut. It's a cut.
So you were right. Oh,
Do you find, or did you find, that the music appreciation, the audiences, are different in Europe than they are in America?
Yes, of course. No question about it. Europe, however, has a cultural tradition going back thousands of years, and ours, as we know, is a young country. We are just having our bicentennial, and that expresses itself in a difference of appreciation. But I think everything is here so young and fresh and promising. I have seen great changes in the years in which I have been.
Did that make your work more difficult?
Made it much easier. Because what you lost in terms of lacking preparation on the part of audiences or students, you gained in the freshness of approach, in the willingness, in the lack of prejudices. You see, because I might be prejudiced myself, I just love America, you know, my country. To this day, we went repeatedly to Europe on the ship. to this day I cannot pass the Statue of Liberty without going on board, and it is usually 5 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock at night, you know, and really be so deeply moved by what it means. And that taught me an important lesson about sculpture. After all, it's not a handsome statue, and it means more to me than the Pietà of Michelangelo. Why? Because it has his message for me. And I think in all art, what it conveys to you.
It's so emotionally significant.